Well, now we'll listen to Yaroslava Mozerova's last interview with Radio Prague that David recorded with her just 2 weeks ago. She had a long association with UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. In 1999, she was appointed president of the UNESCO General Conference, and she remained active in the organization until her death. She was convinced of the role that UNESCO could play, especially in education, and this was the subject of David's conversation with her.
Really, the aim of UNESCO is to improve the quality of life. It's not a political organization at all. It's not only science, education, and culture, but also democracy that UNESCO promotes. Most people associate UNESCO mainly with cultural heritage, but that is a mistake. It's important, of course. But the main pillar of UNESCO is education, access to education. When you hear the delegates from different parts of the world, different cultures, different traditions, there's one thing all of them agree on, and that is that the only tool for better or worse is education.
And how did you become involved initially in UNESCO?
Well, my first act that had something to do with UNESCO was right after the Velvet Revolution, when I, together with two other women, wrote a letter to the Minister of Culture to speed up the process of getting Prague listed on the UNESCO Heritage List, lest we spoil the city. And I think we saved it. I think really UNESCO already prevented some architectural crimes.
And for you personally, from this aspect of preserving the cultural heritage, you rapidly moved on to different aspects of and further aspects of UNESCO's work, didn't you?
I do share with my other colleagues the belief that access to education is most important, especially in Africa, because the areas where there are people, illiterate people, with no access to any kind of information is enormous. And the only way to improve the economical situation in such places, also in Asia and some places in South America, is for the people to get at least basic education and basic skills.
And so what practically is being done in the field of education?
Well, for instance, I keep supporting or promoting that money has to be spent for establishing municipality radios, because in the areas where people are illiterate, the spoken word is the only way of getting information across to the people. Vital information is how to prevent AIDS infection, where to get medical help, where to get basic education. Only the spoken word, nothing else. Not even pictures will help. People are not used to reading pictures or taking them in.
And so UNESCO will help to provide the framework and the know-how to make these local or municipal stations, radio stations,
yes,
work.
Yes, exactly. UNESCO always cooperates with the country concerned, of course. So the country concerned has to express a wish to have this or that. But the countries are also encouraged to develop, for instance, the network of the radios. And in areas where it's been already introduced, it really works.
You mention the fact that UNESCO is, since the fall of communism, since the end of the Cold War, has focused more on democracy and the principles of democracy. As somebody from a previously communist country, what did you try to bring in to the General Conference as president from your experience of having lived through totalitarianism?
I think I didn't bring so much to the General Conference as to the work of the Committee for Conventions and Recommendations, the so-called CREI. It sounds uninteresting, but it's in fact a committee which deals with gross violations of human rights. And it is very important that I am there and that my Hungarian colleague is there, because it's very important that there be members that experienced the authoritarian regime, yet are free to talk about it now and know how to interpret the letters from the governments, you know, which are so similar, no matter if it's the far left or far right, the language.
How do you deal with these cases, with these governments? Well, it must be a very difficult path to tread if you're actually trying to help the people who they're imprisoning.
If you have the experience how a totalitarian regime functions, how it reacts, how far can you go, then it's much easier to cope. But the main value of this committee as compared to others, because there are, of course, many agencies dealing with human rights, the main special value of this committee is that it deals strictly confidentially. So when a totalitarian country releases a prisoner of conscience or improves prison conditions or allows a discriminated group of young people to enter university, no one brags about it. There's not a single word in the media about it, so that the country concerned doesn't lose face in the country nor internationally.
And you have a background as a diplomat as well, don't you? So this must help enormously in this kind of very delicate negotiation.
And also I have a good knowledge of people, which is important.
Do you think that worldwide, that respect for human rights is improving? Obviously there was a wave of optimism with the fall of communism and totalitarian regimes. Do you think, are you generally speaking optimistic?
Yes, because you see, I was on the committee, the Cray Committee, the key committee that I care so much about, before I became president of the General Conference. And now I came back again. And I can see the slow move towards democracy in a number of countries where you would not expect it at all. But there was no dialogue before, there is a dialogue now. And we've had releases from places you wouldn't believe.
Can you name some of the countries where there have been significant improvements?
I mean, I can tell you a story, but I cannot tell you where it happened.
Tell me that story then.
Okay. So there was a case of a prisoner who was sentenced to 30 years imprisonment under very harsh conditions in a faraway country. Gradually, as we applied pressure, the prison conditions improved very much. The person in question could receive books, reading material. She could even receive food parcels from her family. She was moved from a windowless cell to a cell with a window. She was allowed walks in the yard. Now my colleagues from the democratic countries that never went through what we went through said, well, so what? They didn't think these concessions were great, but I realized how in that particular case, in that particular country, how enormous these concessions were. And I said, well, this is a country where it would be worth it to visit the country and see what one could achieve. So I went, and I was afraid I would be introduced to the local National Commission for UNESCO, shown the sites, and sent home. That could have happened. And never again would a visit to the country concerned be approved of. But no, I was received by three government members, the last one being the most important one, as I was told. And he held a long speech where he explained the difficult situation of his multi-ethnic country and that they are working on a democratic constitution, but that they have to go slowly, that if there was a drastic change, it would be bloody. And I believe he was right. Taking into consideration all the facts of the country, I would think he was right. At the end of his speech, he said, as far as the matter you are interested in is concerned, it will be discussed. That was all. No names mentioned, nothing. Then I held a long speech that our countries have, of course, a very different cultural and political background and traditions, and that our opinions, of course, differ. But there are things that we could learn from them, as, for instance, respect for old age. And at the end of my speech, I said that I trust in the generosity of his government. The person was released in 10 days. Even now I have goose flesh when I think about it. In 10 days. It was, of course, understood by both sides that there will be no press conference, no nothing. Silence.
When I spoke a while ago to another Czech diplomat and writer like yourself, Viktor Fischl, he told me that one of the things that he's done in both his work as a writer and a diplomat is you have to be able to think yourself into the mind of the person sitting at the table opposite you when you're negotiating, when you're talking to a politician, for example. In cases like that, in cases of totalitarian countries which are really moving so slowly towards reform, can you sympathize or empathize with these people you're talking with?
I cannot sympathize, but I can understand, which is the difference. I mean, in the case that I was now talking about, I really believe that the minister who was saying how that they could not afford an abrupt change towards democracy, I'm sure he was right.
Dr. Mozarova, thank you very much indeed for talking to me.
You are very welcome.